Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keeping the Faith is Ardella Perry Osler. Ardella is the author of Learning to Love Olivia, a daughter's journal of her mother's journey through Alzheimer's. So today we're going to be talking about Alzheimer's, how it affects families, and Ardella's very good book about her experience with her mother having that condition up until her death. What, was that a year ago?
Almost 2 years.
Almost 2 years in December. Now. Mm-hmm. And your book has just come out this year. It's a wonderful book. I really
Thank
enjoyed
you.
Reading it. I've been through it twice, once earlier and then once again yesterday and today. And I'm looking forward to having our conversation. But to let listeners kind of know who it is that's writing this book, let's talk a little bit about your background growing up with your mother. That was in Pembroke, Illinois, right?
Right. A lot of people don't really know what Pembroke is. It's about 17 miles southeast of Kankakee, which is connected. People usually think of Chicago when they think of the area. So it's a very country area, rural. We had, there were seven of us in the family. I was the middle child.
There were two sisters and the rest boys.
Yeah, five boys and two girls.
And where were you in the lineup?
I'm the middle. There are three older than me and three younger than me.
In the middle.
Yep.
Now, I learned in your book, Learning to Love Olivia, that Olivia Blanche, your mother, was married three times.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
My father died when I was, probably about 6 or 7 years old. And then my mother really was a single mother, raised us in the country. We did everything we needed to do in terms of having our own garden, taking care of us. And she eventually became a nurse. And so we were able to just have her as our main, source of support. And then when I was probably late teenager, early 20s, my mother remarried. And her husband, he lived maybe about 4 or 5 years after the marriage, and he passed.
Home.
And then when she married again, by that time, all of her children were grown, and so she married as a senior at that point.
And outlived that husband as well?
Yes.
Tough stock.
Tough stock. Very, very right. Tough stock, yeah.
So when you were growing up in Pembroke, where did you go to school?
I graduated from Pembroke Consolidated School District. Actually, I went back there as a teacher. And my first year of teaching, I was in the same classroom that I had been in fifth grade.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, so I went to Pembroke, and then I graduated from St. Anne High School. And later in my career, came back and worked at St. Anne for a while.
Now, you attended and graduated from the University of Illinois.
Yep, University of Illinois in Champaign.
College of Education.
Yes, that was for my bachelor's degree. And then later, my master's, two master's degrees I received from Governor State University. So my background is education with master's in special ed as well as in educational administration. I never became a principal, but the work I do right now is around working with schools that are not making what we call adequate yearly progress. So we have grants from the Illinois State Board of Education, so we work with schools that are struggling.
Now, is this a government position or a private industry?
Government position that is based on government funding and politics and the governor signing the budget and all of that. So.
Have you had a paycheck recently?
Yes, I did. I actually got a raise recently, but I right now, because of changes, may only be hired through December. So we're waiting to see what happens with a new grant that's coming in. My position may change, but that's, in
God's
hands.
Have you worked in this position?
About 8 years.
Eight years.
Yeah, I was a classroom teacher for 26 years. And then for about 3 years, I worked with the Illinois State Board of Education in a position called Educators in Residence. And then that changed into the position I have now as coordinator for the Area 4 System of Support. That's what it's called.
Now, you mentioned going back to teach in the same school, in fact, the same classroom where you were a student, but you also taught in Champaign-Urbana?
No, I never taught in Champaign.
You did not?
No, I didn't. When I left Champaign after I graduated, I went back and taught in Pembroke.
And were there that whole time?
Yeah, I was there for about 4 years in the public school. Then I did about 14 years in a private school.
Oh.
before I came to Kankakee and taught then maybe another 10 or 11 years in the public school in Kankakee.
And since some of your former students may well be listening today, since this program is heard all the way to Chicago and Indianapolis, what schools did you teach at? Let's hear the names.
The first school would have been Lorenzo Smith School. Okay. That would have been in Pembroke. And then when I was in Kankakee, it was King Middle School. And before I went to Kankakee, we had a private Christian school that was called Seidel. That was the Christian Institute for Developing Altruistic Leaders. I did that for about 14 years.
Wow. So, now, was that a school sponsored by a church or a combination of Christian churches?
A combination of things. They were mostly sponsored by the Pembroke Community Reformed Church at that time under Hezekiah Brady. Was the main person. And we got a lot of our funding from the Reformed Church, but then some from individuals. But eventually, you know, funding does. And we finally had to close the school. But, yeah, a lot of our students that left there, actually all of our students that left the private Christian school graduated from college.
Oh,
and
wow.
They went to college.
Okay. Yeah, they at least had a chance.
They all went to college and had a chance. And the ones who graduated were the ones that had, you know, very supportive parents.
Okay. So. Now, when you came to the University of Illinois, may I be bold and, well, since you've mentioned in your book your current age, when did you come, what year did you come to the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign?
It would have been 1968.
And how many African-American students were there here in those years?
Curtis would probably know better than I would. Very few. Actually, when I came to the University of Illinois, it was for that reason. There was a program that was trying to get more black students on campus because the University of Illinois would have lost its funding if it did not have a certain number of black students on campus.
And, it didn't have them.
No, it didn't. So we were called Project 500 at that time. And so they were looking for really basically just giving funding to black students to go to school. So that was actually how I got in school in 68.
And that program became rather famous here
because it did make
the national news eventually.
For various reasons.
For various reasons, that's right. Well, we don't have time to go into that. We'll have to have a whole separate program where we have people come back who are part of Project 500. But obviously there were many people in that cohort who became so important in the society and the culture.
Very pivotal time,
That's right. Well, growing up in Pembroke with your mother, Olivia Blanche, when you use the term Olivia Branch in your book, Learning to Love Olivia, you're often talking about what you remember about her when you were a child.
Right.
What was she like as a person, as a mother, as a personality, as a single mother raising seven kids?
You know, as a child, I don't think you ever really see your parents as a human being. You see them as a mother. She was very strict, you know, very demanding, and she wanted things done when she wanted them done. But she was also a very moody person. And as an adult, I look back now and realize probably some depression.
Sure.
Yeah, but for the most part, it was just, you know, she gave you your rules. You had to get it done. And she really pushed education quite a bit. We read all the time in the home. She would talk to us and sit us down and read to us. Kept us in church. So the spiritual side was very strong as far as she was concerned.
And when you say kept you in church, how often a week would you be in church and for how many hours?
You have to understand the Black Baptist Church at that time.
I've had a little acquaintance.
When you went to church Sunday morning, you know, you got there for Sunday school.
What time was that?
Sunday school probably started at 9:30.
Uh-huh.
And then morning worship probably started, you know, around 10:30, and you might get out about 1:32, depending on how the spirit ran that day. And if there was a midday program, you'd run home, get something to eat, come back for maybe a 4 o'clock program sometimes. And then there was about 6 or 6:30. That was what we call BYPU, which was the Baptist Youth Training Program or something like that. Like, it's like an afternoon Sunday school. Then after that, you had a evening service. So that might have started around 7. And again, depending on the spirit, you might have got out about 10. You're looking at, we didn't have watches, but you're looking at the clock thinking, okay, Rev, I have to go to school in the morning.
And that's just on Sundays.
That was just on Sundays. And then there was prayer meeting during the week, but I was one of the crazy kids who went to prayer meeting. Most of the kids.
You did go.
I did go. I would go.
That was your choice.
That was my choice to go to prayer meeting. I don't know why. I think I've just always had kind of a little bit of a spiritual sense. So I would be one of the few kids sitting up in prayer meeting, you know, with the old songs and the old people.
But what night was that?
Wednesday nights. Wednesday. That was Wednesday night. And then I don't think we had any other special programs during the week, but at least definitely, you know,
choir
2 days
practice?
A week.
Did you sing in the choir?
We sang in the choir. Choir practice was probably, it might have been on Saturdays. You know, I can't even remember when we had choir practice, but I know it wasn't on Sunday. So we probably did that Saturdays or maybe even Wednesday or something.
You mentioned that when your mother was suffering from Alzheimer's in her last couple years, that those early church songs were things that, when everything else was gone, they were still there.
Right. And not just for her, but even for the other residents and the facility that she was in, I was just totally amazed that they couldn't remember their names, but they could remember, you know,
the
Jesus
words.
Loves me, this I know. Yeah, that did a lot for me. But it let you know that there's always, even with the Alzheimer's, there's always a person, you know, inside that you can reach back to with some memory that they have.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith with Ardella Perry Osler. Her last two names are hyphenated, P-E-R-R-Y hyphen O-S-L-E-R. Her husband, Curtis, happens to be in the studio, but he's promised us he'll be quiet while we talk with the author of this book. But he has mentioned it in her book, Learning to Love Olivia, a daughter's journal of her mother's journey through Alzheimer's. Curtis and I knew each other when we both worked for the University YMCA here at the University of Illinois. We worked particularly together on a project where some of the listeners to this show who are long-term listeners will remember there was a time when the University YMCA would help raise funding by receiving donated vehicles. And Curtis happened, among other skills, know how to detect what was wrong with cars and often how to fix them so we could then resell those cars. And so he and I had some interesting times with vehicles. People would donate and then we would sell that would help the Y, and people would often get a good bargain and people could get dispose of vehicles rather than having to sell them. Now, the Y no longer has that program, so please don't call and offer to do that now, because Curtis isn't there and I'm not there, and the new folks have other ways to survive, but we had some interesting years there for a while. That's why I am so pleased to be able to talk with Ardella about her book, because tell us when you married Curtis. You left that out in your little mini biography. How could you forget him?
Almost 7 years ago. Curtis and I married, actually, our anniversary is this month. It'll be 7 years, July 30th. So that's a little hint, Curtis. Okay. No, but about 7 years ago. And the interesting thing is when we talked about, I don't know how much of this you want, but Project 500, I met Curtis's first wife. And she and I were best friends I first came to school. And back in, you know, 68, and she and I were very good friends. And then even through the course of her illness and the things that she went through and raising her children and knowing her children and whole family for decades. And then after she passed, our relationship changed. So that's a whole nother story. So we've been married 7 years.
7 years. And Curtis, you mentioned in your book, Learning to Love Olivia, Curtis had to be the caretaker for both, not only both of his parents, but his wife died, sadly, rather early.
About 8 years ago. And I think that when you talk about being a caregiver, I think only caregivers can get that sense of what it takes. I think having Curtis around was such a blessing, because he understood how much I had to give, and he wasn't demanding that he have as much time, because he knew how much it took to give to someone who's suffering.
What you were going through. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about your book and some of the issues you raise. There are many of them. And again, I told you before we started being on the air, I did write a little mini review today on what's that site called where people could buy this book? Lulu?
Lulu.com.
L-U-L-U.com.
Yeah.
And that's a website for independent books, sort of, isn't
it? Right. They do what's called print on demand.
Uh-huh.
And then that way I'm not left with 1,000 books in my basement that I could never sell.
Yeah.
They just, when you order them, they print them as you order them.
Right.
And then the cost is a little bit different, but...
But the cost of your book is very reasonable. It's selling for less than $10.
Yeah, it is.
And people can go to lulu.com and order this book, Learning to Love Olivia. So let's talk about some of the issues. One of the first things you begin with is talking about your family, your siblings, the people whose mother was suddenly, well, maybe not quite so suddenly, but in need of much more care.
Right.
And the struggles you were going through. She was living alone at home in a house she'd been in for how long?
Yeah, well over 30 years and very independent and prided herself on being independent and being able to take care of herself.
And she'd been a working woman all of her
Much all of her life, yeah.
Yeah,
but there were a lot of years. She didn't start to work until maybe the late 60s when she became an LPN. But before that, you know, working at home. But she hadn't been in the work world because she was raising 7 kids.
Sure.
Yeah, but then she started back in the late, so maybe mid-70s to have a full-time job and had always worked,
right.
You know, since then.
And what was she like as a mother? You started to say earlier that she could be demanding.
She's very strict. She suffered
from depression. How did that end up as a mother in her 80s?
You saw some of the same personality. The determination was always there. The wanting to have her way and do it her way, she never lost that.
Uh-huh.
She would speak up for herself when other people in the center may have been a little bit more aggressive than she was. So
now the center you talk about is?
That was a facility that was an Alzheimer's. They had an Alzheimer's unit. And I purposely said center because I didn't want to use the name of the actual facility that she was in Kankakee. But it's a unit that has different phases of it. It doesn't have to just be dementia. They can be like an assisted living center. But the wing that she happened to be in was one that only had Alzheimer's patients. And so they were doing things to stimulate the brain, doing special activities. And the setting was such that she really couldn't get out on her own. It was a locked facility. And even though because my mother really was almost in some ways kind of a shy person, people who would meet her probably wouldn't have thought that. But she wasn't very overt. She would not have wandered. Other people we could see would get out and wander, but she wasn't much of an adventurer. She would kind of just, you know, stay to herself a little bit. So that wasn't the problem with the wandering. The problem was that she had to be placed was that of forgetting to eat.
Sure.
And not knowing how to cook anymore and not knowing who to let in and who to not let in the house. It was that type of thing.
Now, you describe in some of your early chapters, and we might say that this is a journal that you kept for a bit over 2 years during your mother's last, February 14th, 2011, was the last entry, and it began November 9th, 2008.
Yeah, about 3 years.
So a little over 3 years. And then you have another reflection back on it from your birth date on September 12, 2011,
right.
As the last entry before the very good obituary that I suspect I could detect your hand in the wording of a lot of that.
Okay. You're right.
A wonderful obituary that you share as an epilogue to your book. When your mother was still at home and trying to live, talk about some of the difficulties that you and your siblings had to deal with. For example, her burning up pots and pans and fear of fire.
Right. You know, and one of the things that I guess I need to mention, too, in terms of the 7 of us, all of us don't live in the area near her.
Sure.
I was about 2 miles away, and the closest to that was a brother who was like up in Flossmoor. So really, I was the closest person to her. So that was why a lot of the responsibility fell to me.
Oh, the brother in Flossmoor was Jason?
It was Jason.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then my sister was, you know, out of state and in Kentucky, and other people out of state, one brother in Chicago. So you didn't have people who were really there to do the work, but a lot of it meant checking on her more. Before, you just like, oh, she's okay, I don't have to check. But as time went on, you realize, once we realized it was dementia, you realize you did have to check, because she would, she told us later, she would put things on the stove and forget that they were on the stove, so you always worried about fire. There was one episode where I went to her house, I don't know if I wrote about it in the book, but it was like, really, the weather is like it is now, extremely hot. And I had seen her the day before and started not to go by. But then as I was driving home, you know, Spirit just like, you need to go see her. And I went by, and she was on the couch and had not turned on the air conditioner. And she had central air. It was that she didn't remember actually how to turn it on, and was also thinking that I don't want to run up a bill. And so she's on the couch literally in heat exhaustion, and it's close to 100 degrees outside. So that was a little bit scary, you know, knowing that they're forgetting how to regulate the heat, how to regulate the air, and they could actually put themselves in danger.
But since this process at a person who has this difficulty as they age mm-hmm. is gradual,
it is.
It's very difficult for families to know when do we
intervene.
Bring up the subject, try to get them to agree to go to a facility where they get more care, force them to go.
Right. It's probably one of the harder decisions you will make in your life. And even just the initial intervening, because my mother, again, being very strong-willed, you know, there were times that you don't want to get in your parents' business. And so your thought is that, you know, she can handle herself.
Sure.
She's doing her work. But she would sometimes ask me to do her checkbook. And from that, I just thought, oh, she doesn't like to do the numbers. But as time went on and she was more confused doing the checkbook, then those were little signs that you could see that something is a little bit different. And you do have to step up and intervene.
Let me take a minute to reintroduce our guest for listeners who may have joined us later. And let me give the phone numbers for people who'd like to make a phone call now that you've heard about Ardella Perry Osler's background and the subject we're talking about in terms of dealing with her mother's journey through Alzheimer's. The numbers are 333-9455 in the 217 area code if it's a local call to this Urbana location. If it's long distance, there's a toll-free number you may use, 1-800-222-9455. So in Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL, the call letters of the station, or long distance, 1-800-222-WILL, 9455. To be talking with Ardella Perry Osler, author of Learning to Love Olivia. Olivia was her mother who died just 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
My mother died less than a year ago, last December. She did not have Alzheimer's, although she was becoming more forgetful. Mm-hmm. There were some issues, but she did not have that very serious problem. Incidentally, some of the things you talked about in your book, though, were also problems we had. When do you mm-hmm. say you can no longer drive? When do you say your family no longer, even with paid help, can keep you living in the home where you've been for so long?
Right.
We need to take you somewhere else. Is that more of a problem in the Black community than in the Caucasian community? I noticed in the Champaign County Nursing mm-hmm. Home where my mother was for the last 8 years of her life,
mm-hmm.
There were not very many African-Americans there.
Mm-hmm. I read something. I was checking something on the Internet last night, and it talked about the fact that African-Americans tend to have more vascular diseases.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they probably would have more dementia. But the truth of it is that the cost of caring for someone in a facility like that is so high. That could be the reason you don't see people who may not have the resources to actually house them in that type of facility. And the waiting list, if you were in a position where you had to do Medicaid, that waiting list is pretty long to get in. So sometimes, because my mother actually was the only Black person in the facility she was in.
Yeah.
And it was very expensive.
It
was a real financial strain to do that. But it was a blessing that we were able to do it, but it was a real financial strain. So that could be why you don't see people in facilities. They cost so much.
And the other issue, I think, is that it's possible, I can't remember where I read this, But I think it's possible that there may be cultural differences in terms of what people feel is sort of appropriate to dealing with parents.
Right. And sometimes you're right, because sometimes people feel as though they would think of it as you put your mother away.
Yeah.
You know, why wouldn't you keep your mother as long as you could?
And, sure.
Even when you talk about mental health in the Black community, you know, we all have crazy uncles.
Yeah.
You know, even anybody has crazy uncles, sure. and people just kind of make...
I am one, actually. My nephews would tell you.
Oh, you know how Uncle George is, honey. Don't worry about it. That's Uncle George. You know, and so they do that, but then they don't always get the help for Uncle George that he needs.
Right.
And so there is sometimes a cultural, but also mostly an economical difference.
Uh-huh. And it is very expensive. And as you say, it can be hard to get into government-supported programs.
Right.
And sometimes that takes the help of attorneys, and that
it
takes...
Does. Yeah, but just people saying, I wouldn't do that to my mother, they don't see that. They see that as doing something negative to her, as opposed to, I need help to get it done. I need some resources myself to get it done.
Well, one of the difficulties you talk about very honestly, and this is a wonderfully honest book that you've written, is one of the problems is embarrassment on both people's part.
Right.
When a person who's been independent and self-confident and have achieved a lot in life suddenly becomes helpless and needing even help changing their underwear.
Exactly.
I mean, it's, you know.
It's hard to, you have to get over for yourself the embarrassment of, you know, my mother has Alzheimer's, and you really try to help them. You try to do everything you can not to embarrass them and to leave them with their dignity and leave them with their honor. I had a thing that when my mother passed, I told my sister, when she dies, we're going to put panties on her. And she was like, what's with the panties,
what's
though?
That?
That's
how
you keep talking about the panties. I said, because she had to lose so much of her dignity, you know, to go from, you know, having to wear, you know, I don't want to call them adult Pampers, you know, baby diapers. I mean, but
depends,
to do that,
yeah,
the Depends. But eventually she had to go to even beyond Depends, almost like the diaper, the very
end. Mother. Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's losing some dignity.
Right.
And my mother was a very proud woman. So for me, that was a way to restore some of that, to put her panties back on.
And my mother had four sons and no daughters.
Mm.
So there were extra problems with that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. You're right. Because
and
there's
she
some
was
things.
A very modest woman. And,
some things you don't want to have to do.
That's right. That's right.
Even though they did it for you.
I know.
And I think
that's the other thing.
I think that's what you flip in your mind. You say, because my mother at some point said, okay, so now you the mother?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
We're about halfway through our program with Ardella Perry Osler, the author of Learning to Love Olivia, a daughter's journal of her mother's journey through Alzheimer's. We'll be getting back to Ardella in just a moment. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, although I have a couple of very able substitutes often when I'm traveling or unavailable. But today, I'm happy to be in the studio with someone whose wedding I went to 8 years ago when she married a friend of mine, Curtis Osler, who's also in the studio but choosing to be silent today, which is fine. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the next few weeks, let me let listeners know that next week we'll be talking with David Crowley about some of the theological books, Christian theological books he's found of interest in the last year or so, last several years. That'll be a phone interview on July 22nd. Later in August, we'll be hearing from one of the University of Illinois students who helped design and build the Solar Decathlon House. Since this program deals not only with religious issues, but issues of ethics and values, of course, how to have a house that's almost totally energy independent is a fascinating project. We'll learn about that August 5th. Two people from Protestants for the Common Good staff who educate people about issues in the state of Illinois that are facing the state legislature will be our guests on August 12th. That's Laura Dean Frederick and Courtney Eccles. Later in August, Elizabeth Meyer Bolton will be our guest, who's heading up the SALT project, something that some a group of progressive Christian churches are using to sort of spread the word about their mission. Later in September, we'll be interviewing Christina Katazanite, who is the director of the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute here at the University of Illinois, that offers many programs and classes, some on religious and spiritual issues, and on many, many others as well. We'll be talking with her on September 9. Another short announcement about a musical program that's coming up here in the Champaign-Urbana community on July 28. That's a Saturday in Folinger Great Hall of Cranert Center for the Performing Arts. A combination of three groups, the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, conducted by Chester Alwis, the Prairie Ensemble, conducted by Kevin Kelly from here on the WILL staff, and Prairie Voices, conducted by Laurie Matheson. Those three groups will be combining with a concert in honor of Nicholas Temperley on his 80th birthday. Wonderful professor of music, School of Music here at the University of Illinois. Some of the things performed will be Handel, Sam Wesley, Thou Shalt Keep Him in Perfect Peace, Michael Tippett, Spirituals from a Child of Our Time, Charles Ives, Symphony No. 3, The Camp Meeting, Ralph Vaughan Williams, a number of other pieces, Handel, The King Shall Rejoice. Should be a wonderful evening. $15, I think, is the price for folks. There's a cheaper price, I believe, for students. Again, Cranert, July 28th. 7:30 in Folinger Great Hall. It'll be part of the Anglo-American Musical Connections, people who will be on this campus studying English music from the British Isles and America, and a special concert in honor of Professor Nicholas Temperley on his 80th birthday. Well, let's get back to our guest here on Keeping the Faith today. Again, let me give the phone numbers, 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana area. If it's long distance, a toll-free call, 1-800-222-9455. Our good engineer, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and put you in line to talk with our guest today, Ardella Perry Osler. Ardella, one of the things that I appreciated most in your book was, like as I mentioned earlier, your honesty. You talked about how difficult your mother could be.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't help that she was losing her memory and was disoriented and didn't know what was real and what she was imagining. Mm-hmm. But she also was just cantankerous.
Yeah.
And some of us are like that, some more often than others.
True.
How did you deal with it? What spiritual resources did you have to call on?
I've prayed quite a bit. She made me. Actually, that's how the journal started, was a way to release just some of my own frustration, my questions. But I think knowing ultimately that God is in control and you know, I had to keep looking at what is God doing in her life and try to think of it, you know, in that point of view. But also learn not to take it personally. I don't know if I had learned that before my mother had Alzheimer's. I probably took stuff personally. But I had to learn that she could not control some of this, and I had to let some of it go and just say, ask God for the strength to do this.
What help was your congregation? You mentioned your church fairly frequently and people from your congregation.
The reason I'm laughing is that I talked to my pastor this morning. He's like, okay, you put a plug in.
What church is that?
Gee, thanks. It's the Greater New Hope Missionary Baptist Church in Kankakee. Pastor is Reverend Howard Wills.
What street is it on?
That's 1591 East Cedar Street.
What time does its service start on Sunday?
He's going to love you.
I'm a former pastor.
Okay. Service starts at 10:45. Sunday school is at 9:30. Morning worship is at 10:45. And Bible study is Wednesdays at 6:30 and at 12 noon.
Now, if you go to a service there, say on Sunday, does it cost anything to go? Are there tickets required?
No. It's free. It's free. But you know what? But the serious part of it is that my pastor's father had Alzheimer's.
Oh.
And so having had that experience because I had really had just changed churches. And so to be there with a pastor who had walked the same roads, you know, you could actually, he understood, you know, some of the grief and the things that I was going through. And so I did explain to him when I came, I said, you know, I'm very active in the church, but right now my ministry is taking care of my mother. So sure. There are things that I could do, but I can't do that.
And so you had to pull back from some of the things you were doing in the church.
Exactly.
And in fact, some of the people in the church started spending a lot more time with your mother and with you.
Right. We had one of the ladies from our former church was a very close friend of my mother's, Mrs. Monday.
A prayer partner.
A prayer partner, right. And she would go every Tuesday and spend time with my mother. And other friends would come by, you know, when they could from time to time.
How helpful is that to have someone show up on a regular basis like that?
It's very helpful because it takes the burden off of you at least for one day or for a small amount of time. You can know someone else is with her, someone else is also keeping tabs on what they see. Because just because someone's in a facility doesn't mean that it's a perfect place and everything's okay. You have to always, it's like having a child in school. You have to always watch and check, you know, follow up on their care. And she may have seen things in my mother that I didn't see. So to have somebody else to compare notes when my brother would go or my sister would go, it was helpful to have someone else looking and supporting the work and getting it done.
One of the things you mentioned in your book that I found very insightful was that you reached the place where you realized that what you needed to do was to be with your mother rather than to do for your mother. Tell us about
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And I had gotten that concept from another book that I read, is that we can get so busy in the work that we forget about the person. And so I had to learn to not just focus on what I had to get done for her, but to look at, in a sense, what does she need today? There were some days you would go and you couldn't get through, and it would be a tough day for you. But you just had to always pray, what does she need today, and how do I handle, you know, what she's giving back to me? Because sometimes she was very compliant. Other times she was adversarial, and you had to figure out, okay, how do I step back and deal with this?
There were some times you describe your mother when she was still trying to live alone in her home, mm-hmm. but then also when she was in the first of the two places that she needed to be that had the Alzheimer's unit, and then later in a nursing home when she needed just total care. Yeah. I forget exactly where it was, but it was when you realized that she would use the word stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what that meant. Right.
It meant that she could start something, but her ability to process had really gotten pretty small. You know, it was like watching a child who starts something, and then they look at you like, how do I finish this? And some of it even was just with her own toileting, that she, or taking care of herself, she could be brushing her teeth. And I went in one day, and she was brushing her teeth, and she should have been done, should have been getting dressed, and she was still at the sink, you know, kind of brushing her teeth. So it's kind of like, it's almost like frozen in time.
Sure.
And you have to kind of, you learn to give, you know, smaller directions and just focus them on one thing and try to keep her moving.
Tell us about what was the most difficult thing? It seemed to me in your description it was when she would get angry.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the hardest? Or was it when she forgot your name or when you weren't even sure she knew who you were? What was the hardest?
You know, I knew you were going to ask me that question, and I was trying to decide what the hardest thing was. I think the hardest probably was realizing that she doesn't really know that you're her daughter.
Uh-huh.
You know, I tell people, probably have heard these stories 1,000 times, but I would tell them, it's almost funny, but it's not funny. We were coming home from church one Sunday because I was still trying to have some level of normalcy and picking her up to church and taking her to church. And eventually I had to let that go and realize, you know, my brother kept saying, you know, it's not benefiting her anymore. You have to let that go.
Right.
But we were coming home from church one Sunday, and she looked at me, and she's, you know, on the passenger side, and she said, "Now, is your mother still living?"
Wow.
And I'm sitting there thinking, well, really not. No, she's not. And so I think the hard thing was to really let them go. You grieve. I tell people who are dealing with patients with Alzheimer's, you really grieve twice. And when the Lord finally takes them home, is that final grief. But you're grieving throughout because you really have lost who that person was. So I think that thing when they really, you know, she could say I was her daughter, but she didn't really know I was her daughter. So I think that was very painful to let that go.
I love the phrase. I don't know whether this is original with you or whether you read it somewhere or heard it from someone else, but I had never heard it before. When people would ask you, how's your mother? You would say...
She lives in another country and speaks another language. Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah, she does. She does. She lives in another country, and that's what you get used to. There was a book I had seen once that said, Learning to Speak Alzheimer's.
Oh.
But I think that the phrase could have come from my brother even, but we realized that, you know, she could speak her own language, but we didn't know what the language was.
Yeah.
And her mind was someplace else. And she went back in her mind pretty much to when she was a young mother raising children, because her children meant so much to her. My mother was most proud of her kids. And when she would talk about her kids. And I thought she was talking about my children, but I realized she was really, her mind had gone back to when she was raising us when we were kids, even though she didn't know who we were all the time.
Oh, you know. That's sort of where she was living.
Yeah, that's where she was living.
Again, people who would like to get a copy of this book, Learning to Love Olivia, may go to online, lulu.com, to buy the book. It's under $10. Or if you'd like to email, well, you're not selling it yourself, right?
No, I'm not. They could just get it offline.
So they can get it online at lulu.com. Learning to Love Olivia, a daughter's journal of her mother's journey through Alzheimer's. Now tell us how this book came to be published. Tell us a little bit about what Lifelines is.
Melanie Youngsma is the owner for, and I hope I'm saying her last name right, is the owner for Lifelines. And my brother also does books. And it started as a journal. It didn't start with the intent of writing a book, but it was a journal. And the more I wrote and went back and reread, it was such actually a blessing to me to have some way to express this. But as I began to share with other people who were caregivers, and once or twice I would give them a part of what I had written, and just knowing as you work with other people who are also dealing with parents with Alzheimer's, people need a resource. They need to know, first of all, that someone else is going through what they're going through. So we put that together, and Melanie is an elder at my brother's church, and he connected me with her, and she does, the way she advertises herself is that she likes to help people tell their stories. And so contacted her. At first I typed up everything and then sent it to her, and then we started to process it together.
Tell me about how you wrote this journal. Did you write it longhand? Did you use a computer? Where were you? You mentioned you do it usually early in the morning.
Early in the morning, sitting in a rocking chair looking out the back window, or sitting in front of the fireplace was one of the best places, with a cup of coffee and my feet up. When I had a day off.
Longhand?
Longhand.
Laptop?
Yeah, no laptop. I transferred it later. No, I did it all longhand. So
okay.
I still have the book that it was in originally.
An actual book.
It's an actual journal. I love to write, and I like to write by hand. So I was just keeping my own personal journal. I got a couple of journals around the house. One about Curtis, actually. So,
do you let him read it?
I did before I got married. I don't know if I let him read it now.
I'm sorry. I don't do marriage counseling anymore. I'm sorry. Let's see. I wanted to bring up a couple things.
Okay.
Let me give a flavor to listeners of your voice as you write. Mm-hmm. A selection I picked was a time when you were beginning to notice how extreme your mother's dementia was. I'm reading on page 40. After Mom left the room for dinner, I remembered I hadn't checked the fridge for a while. We'd stopped stocking it with water because Mom was doing odd things with the water, and you couldn't be sure what she would put in the open bottles. Some poor plants and non-plants got watered to death. Mm-hmm. There was a Ladies' Home Journal in the refrigerator, so I just left it there. I sometimes put things back where they belong or throw things away that Mom no longer needs. The hand cream in the bathroom was sitting in a cup with most of the tube squeezed out because its cap was in a bag with the other stuff, but the bathroom did smell good today. So I think that might give people a little flavor of how you mm-hmm. share what you were going through in these journal entries. Now, your book is slim. It's only 72 pages. Mm-hmm. It ends with, I mentioned before, about a 5-page obituary about your mother and some mm-hmm. more photographs. People, incidentally, can also go to your website and see some more photographs of, right, of your mother. Tell your website address.
That's actually on Facebook. If someone went on Facebook, and I don't know if I have it on the card, but it's ARPO, all caps. I think it's facebook.arpo2012.com. Or if they just went on Facebook and put my name in, then they could find a link from there.
And I found it also by putting in Learning to Love Olivia on, mm-hmm, Facebook.
Right.
I searched
It'll
for it
up.
That way.
And okay.
Did find those. It was nice to see those pictures of your mother. Another thing you list in your book are, in spite of all the difficulties, you found some things that you could be thankful for, mm-hmm, and grateful for. And many times in your journal entries, you're thankful to God for blessings,
right,
even in this very difficult time. And at one point, you list on page 42 the strengths, mm-hmm, that your mother still had, even though she was really in bad shape mentally. Would you mind reading a few of those for us?
I'm smiling because we had both pages marked the same place. and you write her strength. I had down that her health is still good. And this was really, she passed in December 2011. I'm sorry, 2010. So this really is a year before she passed, almost October, really right before her birthday in October. So, but her health is still good. She can still walk and talk. She can feed herself and has a good appetite. She takes her medicine. She's not as combative as she once was. She smiles and makes faces that entertain others by rolling her eyes. She reads. She putters around her room and finds interesting places for her stuff. She recognizes if you've changed your hair, and she makes comments. She'll take my hand and look at my nails and comment on the color. She still responds in a way that lets you know she understands some things. She recognizes familiar faces. She remembers the words to songs and will sing along. She holds her head upright and watches things about her. She's still my mom. Happy birthday, Mom. I love you.
You mentioned later in your book, Learning to Love Olivia, about what happened in some of the last few months, mm-hmm, particularly with the difficulty when she was in the nursing home and really needed total care. When she would have a TIA and,
right,
or another medical condition where she would get,
right,
sent to the emergency room.
Right.
Now, suddenly, there's more cost, there's more, mm-hmm, disruption to her life. She, mm-hmm, doesn't know what's happening. She's probably, right, scared. I know my mother was when that, right, happened to her. And the difficulties families have in trying to decide, when do we say, don't take her to the hospital anymore, either,
exactly,
have her put in hospice, like we eventually had to decide with my mom,
right,
or in your case where that didn't seem to be medically appropriate, but, mm-hmm, where your physician finally said, there's nothing else we can do medically. She would not need, like, to be forced, have food forced into her.
Exactly.
Let things progress as they're going.
Right.
Those are very difficult times for families. How did you reach those decisions?
Well, again, through a lot of prayer, but I think our doctor, Dr. Alfred, was very—he was helpful in all along the whole process because he was helpful in helping us get her placed and getting her to understand that she needed to be placed. Excuse me. And then also because we knew that he knew her personally. She had been his nurse as an LPN. She had been his nurse at the clinic, so he had a personal relationship with her as well as being her doctor, and he knew her well enough to know this does not need to continue the way it's going. So I think having you sometimes when you can't make the decision, you have to rely on a doctor and then just pray about what is the best thing for your parent because everybody's everybody's decision is not the same.
Let's talk about one of the specific difficult details that that caused your family to make that decision,
mm-hmm,
and that is the issue of pocketing food.
Right.
People who have Alzheimer's or dementia, and I might just mention that we've done another program here on Keeping the Faith with a family member, a husband whose wife had frontal temporal dementia, has that, mm-hmm, that deteriorating disease, degenerating disease, back in March 20, 2011. If people want to go to that archive program and hear that, you can go to that date, March 20, 2011, to hear that program. But people get to the place where they begin to eat. Mm-hmm. They may feed themselves or they may be fed, But they don't swallow the food. They forget to swallow, and the food is can then choke them, and people can die from that, a rather unpleasant death. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the issues that forced your family and your doctor to mm-hmm. make this decision. Mm-hmm. But then later, your mother just refused food and exactly. water. And, yeah. and of course, yeah. a person can only live without water for less right. than a week.
Right. And I think some of that, because she had a medical background, uh-huh. I think she understood a lot more than she could tell us that she uh-huh. understood. And it really, for her, was a conscious decision that she would always say, I'm tired. Uh-huh. You know, and the doctor was like, oh, you know, that's she's just saying that sometimes. But my sister and I would listen to it carefully, and she would say, you know, when she would say she was tired, I took it as though she was tired of fighting, knowing that her quality of life was slipping away. And she made a conscious decision to refuse food. And there was no way we could force her to eat, you know, because like you said, she would have choked to death if we had forced her to have food in her right. throat. And sometimes you didn't even know it was in there. So that was a problem as well. But that's when you have to accept what someone else has decided and right. say, it's her decision not to eat. You know, what are we going to do? Stick tubes in her? And then her quality of life is just nothing.
Right.
You know?
Your mother had made some earlier decisions that helped you and the family in her last days because she had pre-planned her own funeral.
Yes.
And burial.
Yeah.
Tell us how that came about. It went back to her mother, right?
It did. When her mother had died, maybe in 2003, and she was the person taking care of her and handling the funeral, she had always said after that, I want to make this as easy on you as possible. And so she had done that. She had prepaid everything. And I had found a resume that had all the information about all the stuff she'd ever done. And so, you know, my sister and I talked. She said, well, just because I used to do obituaries as well. That was a small business I had at one time. And so she said, well, just
you
go ahead.
You mean you would write them for other
I would write them for other people and write them for the funeral home. Huh. I had my own business where they would call me, and they would give me their information, and I would take it and turn it into a little story and put the pictures in and the program and everything like that. So putting that together was not a problem. So we had actually put everything together, and because my mother had done that, and she died right before Christmas, so we were ready in that sense, and we had a funeral. She died on the 20th, and we had her funeral, I think, on the 23rd, which was a very quick turnaround for us.
Well, the obituary that you wrote for your mother was one of the best I'd ever read.
Thank you.
And so now I know you had practice. Yeah. We have a caller waiting. Let's go to line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Ardella Perry Osler. Go right ahead.
Yes, this is Julie Ray calling, and I'm a retired hospice social worker, mm-hmm. and I'm so glad that you wrote this book. It's a wonderful gift to the community.
Thank you.
And there also is the Illinois Alzheimer's Association that helps people in all counties and has support groups. And the SIU School of Medicine has an Alzheimer's Parkinson department mm-hmm. that comes out and speaks and has many educational materials. But Naomi Files, you may have read her books.
No.
Naomi Files, she mm-hmm. talks like you do about going into her reality, like if she's talking about her children, mm-hmm. help her get into it with her.
Mm-hmm.
And the music is always seems to be a straight through thing. Mm-hmm. A lady was an organist, and her daughter was a choir director, and her daughter had to help her up and turn her around. She couldn't physically turn herself around anymore mm-hmm. and sit her down at the organ.
Wow.
Then she could play.
Mm-hmm.
But that there is a person inside, and any little way you can connect with them, mm-hmm. even if they can't reciprocate and come back to you, you've given them a little gift in that moment.
Right.
And that, so I'm really re-inspired mm-hmm. by your words.
Thank you, Julie. Thank you.
And your gift to the book.
Right.
Take care.
Okay.
Take good care.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello. Thank you for the call. We can probably squeeze in one more call. I see we have another person I think will be waiting. We'll just ask that person to speak quickly because we are nearing our end time here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. Let me go to that call right now on line number 4, our toll-free line. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead.
Hello. My name is Byron Perry, and I'm calling to congratulate Ms. Ardella Perry. We're proud of her for writing that book.
That's my son.
Well, it's good to have.
Thank you, Byron Perry.
You're welcome.
We're proud of you, too.
Anything else you'd like to say about your mom?
Oh, she's a wonderful woman, and you're doing a really good job on this radio show.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. How many children do you have?
I only have the one son.
Just one son. Where does he live?
He lives in Flossmoor. He and his wife, and they have 3 children. Yep.
And how are you planning your last years to make it easy on your only son?
Good question. Actually, I have given him some of my information, and he sometimes doesn't want to hear it. But you're right. I need to do things like my mother done, the power of attorney, the medical things, all of those things in place.
It really helps, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the financial things we have in place, but you never know what type of medical help you're going to need. And so that's a little bit difficult. But he knows where all my information is.
And kids often don't want to hear, I turned 70 this year, and my children, Dad, don't talk about all that stuff.
But
if you don't, it makes things harder for them. So.
And if you're healthy, I think the parent has to do it first. Because if you can do it first and kind of force the kid to say, we need to look at this.
Yeah.
Because by the time you have Alzheimer's, you can't do it.
Now, since you had to clean out your mother's house where she lived so long with the help of some of your siblings, Ed Curtis, I'm sure, and others, are you getting rid of things now? I haven't done that very well.
Oh, in my own house?
In your house.
I keep saying I'm going to, but it makes you want to because the things that are important to us aren't important to people who have to clean them out
Yeah. We're at the end of our time. We've had a very good hour speaking with Ardella Perry Osler. That's spelled A-R-D-E-L-L-A. Perry Osler is hyphenated P-E-R-R-Y-O-S-L-E-R. Learning to Love Olivia, a daughter's journal of her mother's journey through Alzheimer's, published just this year and available only at a website, Lulu, L-U-L-U.com. Put in Learning to Love Olivia. And you'll find a way to buy that book for less than $10. I highly recommend it for families, particularly who are facing these kind of issues, but also for people who'd like to see how one's religious faith can be very helpful in the time of crisis, a family crisis of medical difficulty. Ardella expresses her faith quite winsomely and certainly not in an overbearing way, but in a way that's very honest and clearly true to her own spirituality. Coming up next week on Keeping the Faith, we'll be talking about books with David Crowley, who's going to be talking about Christian theological books. That's on July 22nd. On August 5th, we'll be talking with Sean Denny, a recent graduate from the University of Illinois, about the Solar Decathlon House that in Washington, D.C. won a number of prizes at a recent competition for solar houses. On August 12th, we'll be talking with two folks from the Protestants for the Common Good about some of the legislative issues, ethical issues that that group has been raising a ruckus about in Springfield, Illinois. On August 26th, we'll be speaking with Elizabeth Meyer Bolton about the SALT project that she works with some other progressive Christian churches. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media.